today's talk is pretty, goes quite a ways in this direction, more than most. Clearly, the representation here for mathematics, metaphysics, quantum information. We're very lucky to have Michael Friedman, who's going to somehow connect them all with a talk entitled, I forget, Anionic. Oh, this is a different title.
Same thing.
The one that was on the
ferromagnets.
Anionic approach to quantum.
Thank you, David. It's
actually from C-Star algebra.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to be able to speak to so many physicists and family members at the at the same time. This is a little bit new to me, not completely new, but a little bit new speaking to physicists. After giving a talk on the preliminary version of this material, I told Jennifer Chase, a physicist that some of you know, who's my boss at Microsoft, I told her that I still felt nervous pretending I was a physicist and using all these large words. And she says, well, don't worry about it. Physicists are also pretending to be physicists. Only they do it better.
Especially when they're telling us everybody.
So this will do for a title. I think the actual title that was posted had something about anti-ferromagnetic models, and that will certainly be the focus. So I'll be talking about what you might think is a technological subject, how to build a quantum computer, but there'll be some mathematics and quantum physics in the talk. And I'm talking about a particular approach which I call anionic approach to quantum computation. Maybe this should be pronounced anionic. It has to do with the possible phases. Any will do. And I've decided to present this as sort of as a sports event. Here are the players. The anionic people are very small insurgency, and I've listed all that I know in the world in alphabetical order. Besides myself, there's Alexei Kataev, currently at Microsoft, Michael Larson, mathematician at Indiana, David Meyer, mathematician and physicist at UCSD, John Preskill at Caltech, a physicist, Chetan Nayak at UCLA, a physicist, and
Zihan. What do I have to do to get on that list?
You can exactly. I'm looking for help. I'm looking for help. Michael. Actually, Matthew is on one of my slides.
No.
But you didn't qualify for this list, because you haven't helped me build this quantum computer yet, but after the talk, you have another chance. Now, on the other side, we have the standard model for quantum computation, and that team is the rest of the world, which is about 500 people that contribute, say, to QuantPH on this subject. Now, the main distinction is that the qubit model, the degrees of freedom on which one is hoping to compute are localized, either localized in space or in momentum space that typically spins on individual protons or electrons, whereas in the anionic approach, the degrees of freedom are more intricate. They're topological correlations. Now, the systems which might be applicable in sort of the standard qubit approach are probably familiar to you. You may have heard lectures on them. Liquid NMR, people like Ike Chung work on that. Solid state NMR has been proposed but not built. There's an interesting article by Bruce Kane on that in Nature 2 years ago. These are various models, optical cavities, which they do at Caltech, ion traps. All these are possible implementations of a mathematical model based on isolated degrees of freedom. Now, what systems can we use on the anionic side? Well, the best systems are just pure math. They have no real-world physics in them all, and they work like a charm. But that might not be satisfying to this audience. So what other examples can we look at? Well, actually, the main motivation, one of the two main motivations for this talk, are fractional quantum Hall effect. these are very delicate systems which occur in extremely time asymmetric situation in the presence of a strong magnetic field, and they're very delicate. They occur at extremely low temperatures, millikelvin, and they're probably not actually suitable for making a quantum computer, but they do illustrate, at least in the minds of some theorists, these anionic properties. And another possibility which Matthew Fisher and collaborators are associated with is a proposal that some high temperature superconductors, cuprates, above their superconducting temperature may exhibit electron fractionalization, and those would count as anions. They actually are not complicated enough in their grading relations to build a quantum computer from, but they are interesting anions. So since I've used this word anion so often now, I'll explain exactly what I need. So the beginning of the slide is not necessary for physicists. Bosons are particles when you have two identical ones and they're interchanged. There's no phase. Fermions, if you interchange the sites of identical particles, there's a minus one phase. The mathematicians think electron or something. Exotic statistics is anything besides this, and this is where I'm using the name anion, sort of for any phase. And the simplest case, abelian, is usually a unit complex phase associated with interchange of sites. And a more interesting and more problematic possibility is called non-abelian on, or anion, just non-abelian anion, where when you interchange two sites with identical particles or quasi-particles, the state of internal symmetries is transformed by some unitary transformation, which might be rather complicated, not just a one-by-one matrix. Now, these kinds of exotic statistics are necessarily two-dimensional phenomenon. The reason is if you have particles in three-space, up to deformation, there's only one way of interchanging them without colliding them. But in the plane, if you have two particles, there's sort of a clockwise and a counterclockwise half turn. And this means that the braid group comes into the game. At the bottom of the transparency, I've visualized a two-dimensional space with, say, four quasi-particles or four point-like excitations, and I've drawn sort of a time history in which they move around in the plane and trace out some braid. And when they return to the same sites that they began on, then there's a representation induced from the braid group, which describes the structure of these twistings and turnings, a representation from the braid group into the space of internal degrees of freedom of the system. And that's where this matrix U would act. So U would be the image of the braid representation. And as David was suggesting, in order to build a quantum computer from anions, certainly abelian is too weak. Non-abelian is necessary but not sufficient. Some non-abelian systems are also too weak, and I'll say a little bit about that maybe in two transparencies. But why would one want to compute with anions in the first place? What are the advantages and disadvantages? Well, the main disadvantage is we're apparently not absolutely sure they exist at all, and that could be a problem. If they do exist, then we're going to have to grab them and braid them more or less at will to execute some program. And for example, the mathematics is completely worked out of how we'd have to braid them to do a particular algorithm, like factor a large integer. So you can ask, how much of this braiding do you have to do to break the cryptographic scheme RSA? And the answer is a few thousand. So that's not a few million, so that's nice, but a few thousand. So.
A few thousand braids or?
A few thousand half twists on a few thousand particles. A few thousand particles, a total of a few thousand half twists.
It
completes with the other model. They're linearly equivalent, basically, the qubit model. So it's also true that the advantages actually come in that discussion of competition with the qubit model. And there are two advantages. I only wrote down one because I ran out of space. One expects an anionic system to be intrinsically fault tolerant, which you do not expect in any of the qubit models. So The typical expectation is that in some gap system, these excitations are point-like. They have exponentially decaying tails, so that when you braid them around each other, it's a rather clean operation. I mean, you don't want the particles to collide. That's what the braiding is all about. And if they come very close, that's a problem too, because they're not actually points. But the error, since it's decaying exponentially, means that the representation approaches the mathematical ideal up to an error which is something like e to the length scale, where how far you keep them apart. And you don't easily find anywhere else in the quantum computing literature a physical proposal in which you get an exponential stability with any physical parameter that you can adjust. So this is quite compelling. And then the other advantage, which I didn't put on the slide, I touched on the first slide, is that because the degrees of freedom are topological entanglement and necessarily large scale, they're less subject to decoherence because of an unwanted interaction with the environment. So the first disadvantage was they might not exist, so I should say what is the status. And on this I was briefed maybe by Chetan Nayak at UCLA, so I asked his opinion, but this is sort of a summary of opinion of physicists I've talked to, and we can discuss this. So the Abelian statistics, which is insufficient for building a quantum computer, seems to be fairly widely believed. In particular, the Laughlin state at filling fraction, the first lambda level 1/3, is well believed to have third root of unity statistics. And then my little joke here, at least in Sweden, because they did give him the Nobel Prize quite recently.
Well, it was a charge.
Well, but on the other hand, these are sort of well-integrated mathematical theories, so it's hard to believe that one aspect of the theory could be true and the other false. I mean, that's the case. The measurements, the evidence for not anionic statistics is indirect. It has to do with other features of the total package of the physical model.
As is the evidence for Fermi statistics.
At nu equals 5 halves, there's again a very compelling mathematical picture, but in terms of real evidence, maybe you'd say it's numerical, approximate wave function, so that's numerical evidence. For a non-abelian state, which topologists would call Chern-Simons theory at the fourth root of unity. So it's SU2 Chern-Simons theory at the fourth root of unity, which basically is the Clifford group as a group. And it's an interesting non-abelian group, but it's not universal for computation. Because it's not dense in the unitary matrices.
Is that the same representation as the Eisenmodel?
I think it is, yes. I think that's right. And then from a paper of Reed and Resnais, that filling fraction 8/5, and again, perhaps the numerical evidence is shakier, but again, it's a nice mathematical discussion, very compelling. There's a computationally complete theory, which is Chern-Simons theory at the fifth root of unity. And in this case, if you look at the map from the braid group into the symmetries of the internal degrees of freedom, you find a dense representation, which leads to a universal model for quantum computation.
So universality requires a dense?
Yes, because you want to be able to move the initial vector anywhere you want by a series of gates. In fact, the next slide addresses that. What is a quantum computer? It's probably time I said. So this is kind of an outline of an abstract description of a quantum computer. It's quite different than if you get a book out of a library or survey article on quantum computing, because that'll start with the qubit C2. But I purposely want to give a description of quantum computation which specializes to that and specializes to anionic computation. So this is sort of a more fundamental description, and the boxes in red are what I'm going to be emphasizing today. So first you need a Hilbert space. Finite dimensional is most convenient. And you need an initial vector somewhere the computation starts at, so you have to prepare a particular vector in the Hilbert space. Then you need something that acts on the Hilbert space. That's the representation. In my case, it's the representation from a braid group. But in the qubit model, it could be the image of gates like control knot and Toffoli gate and other gates. And what this representation does is it takes the initial vector and it moves it in various places. And locality is sorted for free in any model that's related to physics. That is, in some sense, the representation acts on pieces of the degrees of freedom. But the crucial thing for universality is density. That is, you want to be able to affect any transformation you want by a sufficiently long string of gates, because you want to be able to move the initial vector to an arbitrary final position. Well,
let me put it another way. Yeah. You take something which is not dense, but has support on the fine number of points.
Right.
They get more and more. You have a computer that can't do everything.
So, more and more, even as you take longer and longer braid?
You will still be
dense. That'll be dense. If you get...
No, it's always dense. No, but if you took something that wasn't dense...
Yeah, like the Clifford group or something.
Well...
I mean, there's
a sequence of groups that become dense on dense,
yeah.
I think you mean.
Right.
Well, there are no such things. By the way, if you fix a Lie group, you know, this is an old principle. There's actually a bound to the diameter of the quotient homogeneous space, universal bound.
But you could still implement some kind.
Sure. No, that's true. I mean, CS4 actually. In fact, Alexei Kitaev has worked very hard on computational models based on CS4 instead of CS5. Exactly, because he thinks it's more likely that CS4 will exist than CS5.
So you can do something.
You can do some, and maybe you can squeeze out all things if you allow a more complicated model of computation. Instead of just movement by the representation and measurement, you might allow intermediate steps which allow for feedback. That is, you do some representation, you measure, and then based on the outcome of the measurement, you decide how to move to the later gates. It's very natural from a philosophical point of view that you should be able to affect computation by measurement. And this is related to holonomic computational schemes. I can come back to that at the end. So what I'll be focusing on today is what is the Hilbert space that I'm going to propose. And then I'd like someone in the room, looking at you, Matthew, to actually figure out how to make this Hilbert space out of a piece of semiconductor or something, what the representation is. But then just to finish the story, I should say the rest of the quantum computer is a classical computer I call the compiler, and it executes some algorithm which converts something like Peter Shor's factoring algorithm into a word in the braid group. It just tells you what braids to do certain algorithm. And then the final vector is just what you get by doing the representation on the compiled word acting on the initial vector. So you start with the initial vector, you move it the compiler tells you to, and then you have to get some information out by a projector of some kind. That's the observable. So sort of a fundamental...
Is there an abstract notion here of robustness or the correction?
So in this transparency, I've neglected error correction entirely. Okay, in the qubit model, error correction is a major theme, and what you show is that if you can do these operations up to an error of around 1 in a million, then there is a brilliant mathematical device. That can be a machine that can be engaged at that point, once you've reached this error threshold of around 1 in a million, that squeezes the rest of the error out. So if you're willing to suffer an expansion of the circuit size, in practical problems, it's roughly a factor of 1,000 in steps and in qubits. So for instance, RSA, the numbers you should think of, or if you had a machine that made no errors at all, you could crack it with about 3,000 or 4,000 operations on 3,000 or 4,000 qubits. And if you if you had errors of one part in a million, then you could use the error correcting machinery and crack it using 3 or 4 million qubits and 3 or 4 million operations. So you pay, there are two things to notice with those numbers. That is, you have to get very close to perfect before the iteration even takes hold. And then once it takes hold, you still pay a factor of 1,000 in size and time. And I think that this theorem, as a mathematical theorem, has led to some complacency. I think people say, well, it's a theorem, you can error correct, so we're not going to worry. I think one of the arguments for the anionic approach is disbelief that the error correction will ever actually work. That is, the anionic approach, if it works, should correct errors on the physical level.
But has there been analysis of, there are two kinds of issues in error correction, right? One is decoherence. Has there been analysis of decoherence?
Well,
or anion? Or it's not obvious, probably to me, that just because they're logically stable, they're more stable against decoherence.
Well, it depends what model you take for the interaction with the environment. If you take the interaction with the environment that there's some probability for flipping a raw spin that's part of the Hilbert space in which you have this collective state, you know, then you can make an argument that, again, there's an exponential scaling, that the probability, the time, if you create one of these excitations and you put it in a bath of interaction with the environment where you interact with a certain probability rate at each site, you can argue that in the length scale, the time you have to wait before the system decoheres is exponential. That's already done in Alexei's 97 paper on toric codes.
As long as your observable is global.
As long as it's global, yeah. Yeah, I mean, then there's a question, how do you read out the topological observable at the end? There's a risk at the very end of the process as you try to read out the observable. But I think that maybe we'll come back to that point. I think it'll reappear. So as I said, one of the main themes of this talk is whether we can find anions in some model, mathematical model, that could possibly be implemented physically outside the quantum Hall regime. So the hope here is to shed the very low energy scales, the low temperatures, and this very strong chiral asymmetry. And in fact, the model I'll propose has central charge zero. It's a Drinthel double of something. So there shouldn't be any strong magnetic field in the picture. And it seems reasonable, because it's a magnetic system, that the characteristic energies will be much larger. So it shouldn't have to be very cold. So there's an example which sort of building on this idea of Anderson on charge electron fractionalization. There's been a discussion of Fisher and Sentinel and Nyack and Stengel about cuprate semiconductors in their above the TC range. I called that anti-ferromagnetic, but I think it may be better to call it paramagnetic phase or something. Anyway, in this phase, there's a very interesting theory that the electron fractionalizes into charge-on and spin-on, which carry the charge and the spin of the electron separately. And this leads to a very interesting very interesting representation of the Braid group, but not interesting enough to make universal computation. It just amounts to some minus one signs sprinkled in here and there. So whether or not this theory is right, this is sort of precedent that it's logically independent. Today I'll describe another model. And again, I used the word on the transparency, anti-ferromagnetic, but after a long discussion at UCLA, we decided that it should be called paramagnetic with local anti-ferromagnetic properties. Anyway,
you could just call it anionic.
Well, it's a kind of magnet. I'm going to give you a... I'm coming now to this model, however we'll characterize it. It's some kind of magnetic system. It's a spin system. And my hope is that it either exists and is just waiting to be identified, or that some clever person will be able to engineer it once they see the Hamiltonian. So the next order of business is to show you the Hamiltonian. To warm you up for that, I will say that the model can live on any surface. It doesn't have to be the plane, it could be a torus or a hygienist surface. And if there's boundary to the surface, that's good. I like that case, but it's, then there's some important boundary conditions to be given. But today, I'll focus on sort of the middle of the surface in the bulk and just tell you what the model should be in a region that looks like the plane. And here I'll consider Ising spins, up-down spins, so it's, think of a spin-half system, where the spins are located on two cells, so think of them as hexagons in a tiling of the plane. An equivalent terminology, which I've seen more, is the triangular lattice in the plane and the spins are located on the vertices. That's just the dual terminology, so whichever way you like to think about it. I have a computer, a file that prints out hexagonal graph paper. So I like hexagons. So it's
what does it mean, two cell?
Plaquette. Plaquette. Two cell is
plaquette,
sorry. A two-dimensional cell, a hexagon. I call it a two-dimensional cell because on a on a general surface, it might have five or seven sides. That's not so important.
So these are on the sides of the dual triangular.
Yeah, they could be on the vertices or the sites of the dual triangular lattice. And what the Hamiltonian will be, it will be a sum of term which operates on little clusters. So a hexagon and its six neighbors. So each term of the Hamiltonian is local, but not extremely local. Like in the Heisenberg magnet, it's just two at a time. But here you have to think about the whole neighborhood. So up to an overall flip of upspin to downspin, the only thing that's important about the picture is the domain wall between up and down. And that carries almost all the information except for this overall global flip. So I'll be focusing on gamma, the domain wall. And just to warn you, before showing you the formula for the Hamiltonian, I should show you it sort of...
You mean the domain wall?
The plural?
Again, configuration.
Well, it's a superposition. So it'll have... The classical configuration has a domain wall. Oh, plural, like many components?
Yeah.
Oh, the domain wall is not connected in my thinking. Okay. It's like the Great Wall of China. The Great Walls of China. Yeah, it consists of circles or maybe arcs if there's boundary. Here's a picture of it.
Yeah.
This is the red stuff is what I'm interested in. It's the domain wall between pluses and minuses. It's where you go from plus to minus. It's the interface. And I started to...
Non-intersecting closed.
Yeah, non-intersecting closed curves. Now, that's actually the reason for being on the triangular lattice, or equivalently the hexagons, is I definitely don't want to work on the square lattice, where if you had the checkerboard pattern, you'd see these four-fold intersections, right? And then the domain wall would not be what topologists would call one manifold, but instead would be some more complicated four-valent graph. And I that would ruin everything. So this is a picture. I started to cover the entire transparency with hexagons, but got bored. So I stopped there. I was doing this on the train, and I didn't have my graph paper algorithm. So you should imagine this black stuff fills the plane. And then some of these hexagons have a minus, and some have a plus spin. And I've separated the regions of plus and minus by the red lines. And that's what I'm calling gamma, the domain wall. And the Hamiltonian, which comes up now in the next slide, we're almost there, is designed to know two things about the domain wall. It's designed to know about isotopy, that's continuous deformation of the domain wall, and it's designed to know the value, the numerical value of creating a small circle, a little six-sided circle by flipping a spin somewhere.
Can the domain wall take... sharp turn. Oh, it just lives on the links of this honeycomb. Is that?
It can take 120 degree turns, I guess.
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah.
That's true.
In fact, it has to take 120 degree turns. Every time it turns left or right by 120. So it's designed to know about isotopy and a numerical weight D. And D in this talk, I should have put it on the very first transparency it occurs. D in this talk is the golden number. This could be called the golden magnet. D is equal 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, and that's actually very important. The people in C-star algebra know why.
No, but you're going to define a model where D is a continuous parameter.
D is a continuous parameter. It'll be very important that it takes certain values, and this is the first interesting value. There are a few other ones higher up. And H will be designed to know something called the temporary lead category. That's the meaning of teaching it about isotopian circles. And the second theme of this talk, if the first theme was to get away from fractional quantum Hall effect, the second theme is that the ground surface Hamiltonian, H0, because it's an algebra, the temporary lead category is really an algebra, because it has this algebraic structure, we will be able to see into its deformation theory much more deeply than is common in physics. And we will be able to divine somehow that the only way this big degeneracy, it's a highly degenerate ground state for this Hamiltonian, the only way this degeneracy can be partially lifted is to collapse to a quotient algebra. So usually the ground state. The ground state space. So there's a, you know, usually you're thinking of a one-dimensional ground state, but in all these topological computation models, the ground state is very big, the ground state space. There should be a way of saying that without three words. The ground state space is this temporary lead algebra. And when the ground state space has the structure of an algebra, it gives it a rigidity so that the only natural way, at least according to an Ansatz, which I'll explain to you, of relieving some of that degeneracy.
By relieving some of the degeneracy, you mean reducing the Hamiltonian?
Yeah, you add a perturbation to the Hamiltonian, and the effective action of that term, the perturbation term on the Hamiltonian, will create a new ground, a model for the ground state within the original ground state. And that new ground state, the perturbed ground state, should be perpendicular to an ideal of the temporary lead category. In other words, it should represent, it should...
But
my hope is, and this is going to be the main thesis, the thesis will be...
You mean in order to construct that?
No, the thesis would be that if you make a Hamiltonian, which is approximately the one I'm going to describe, H0, and then you shake it in any little way, like by a little bit of dirt in the system, the true ground state of the system will not be this temporary lead thing, but will be the quotient C-star algebra. This temporary lead thing has a very natural semi-definite Hermitian inner product, and it has a unique quotient, which is a C-star algebra. And what I'm going to argue is that physics, benchtop physics, if this is actually made, should find the C-star algebra quotient and produce a much more interesting, smaller ground state, which is still highly degenerate, but is now, it's something that we understand mathematically very well. It's a certain modular category, which has already been studied, and we know exactly how the Braid group acts on it, and we know it's called the Drinfield double of the Fibonacci category. It's the Chern-Simons SO3 theory. It's the Chern-Simons SO3 theory on two labels. So we have this very clean algebraic model that I will try to argue.
Under any perturbation.
Let me develop that theme.
Chern-Simons SO3 at what level?
What level?
What's the central charge?
It's the theory with two levels. With two labels. So it's this.
You mean there are two integral representations of
the. That's right. There's the trivial one and the next one.
So what level is that?
That's k equals two.
K
equals two. The k goes from 0 to k over 2
integral
values.
So why is that?
That's why it's integral.
Even labels within the SU2 theory at the fifth root of unity. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that was the overly lengthy preamble. I mean, the perturbation theory is the most important point of this talk, and that's what I want to get back to. But let me tell you the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is now the talk begins. Now we have the Hamiltonian on the board. Definition of the Hamiltonian. So this I've all said the beginning part before. The raw Hilbert space is just a tensor product of C2s located on each of the hexagons, okay? Another way of saying that, just distributing tensor product over direct sum, is that the raw Hilbert space is the span of all classical spin configurations. So the basis vectors, the classical basis vectors, are simply pictures, as I put up on an earlier transparency, of plus or minus on each hexagon, and a quantum mechanical state is some linear superposition of those pictures. Okay, that's the way you begin any spin model. And then you have to say what the Hamiltonian is. So in order to define the Hamiltonian, I have to define a pair, what it means for a pair of a state, that's a classical spin configuration, and a cell in it. C is a hexagon, it's a cell. I have to say what it means for a pair to be type H and type G. So H is very simple. H just says that the central cell C and all its six neighbors have the same spin on it. That's what H means. G doesn't look at the central spin at all. That could be plus or minus. And it's just the condition that if you look at the six edges going around, the six segments of the boundary of C, that the ones that meet plus spin cells and the ones that meet minus spin cells are each topologically intervals. And then here's the Hamiltonian.
Type A, type G, say it again?
I have a picture. I have pictures on the next slide. So let me just remind, the Hamiltonian is written on the next slide, so let me just remind you that B is the golden number, and when I write bar over a state, I just mean you switch the spin on the central cell. You flip the spin. So here's a picture of G and H to make it clear. So this is the computer graph paper. It's better than mine. I'm sorry it's a little faded. I hope you can read that. So type H, if you have a state, comma, a cell, C, you say that pair is in type H, or is type H, if the cell and its six neighbors all have the same sign. So that can arise this way or this way, and no other way. So that's type H. Type G, it doesn't care what the central sign is. And type G is given by the condition that the domain wall between the central cell and its neighbors, when divided into a plus part and a minus part, that is, the border with plus spins and the border with minus spins are considered separately, that each of those are intervals. So that occurs in these possible ways. You could have 1 and 5, or 2 and 4, or 3 and 3, and two, like that, okay?
And they all have the same weight in the Hamiltonian?
They'll all have the same weight in the Hamiltonian. It won't care. And here at the bottom of the transparency, I give you an example of a central cell which is not type G. If it alternates minus, plus, minus, plus, you see, then the interfaces with plus are two intervals, the interfaces with minus is two intervals. It could also be 3 and 3, like that. So those are not called type G. Now, what the Hamiltonian does is it forces a superposition between G and G bar. Let me put the Hamiltonian back on. So
changes G to G bar.
Hamiltonian, yeah, so now this is the one place where two projectors might be nice.
What terms of the Hamiltonian do on these strings?
Yeah, so let me explain the Hamiltonian now. Now that you kind of absorb what G and H mean, okay? So, by the way, this is physics notation I learned. This is a ket. That means a vector in the Hilbert space. And this is a bra. Oh, I left off that line. Okay, so what this Hamiltonian is, it's a sum of a vast number of non-commuting one-dimensional projectors. The fact that they're non-commuting is rather curious, because usually that alarms people that they won't be able to figure out what the ground state is. But here we can analyze it exactly by topology. Okay, each term means projection onto a particular vector. Let's do the G vectors first, okay? So for that, you should consult this little schematic. Inside the big Hilbert space of classical span by classical configurations, One such configuration is G, with that central cell point to 2, and the other is G bar. G bar means whatever the sign was on that central cell, it's been flipped.
Just the central one or the whole?
Just the central cell. Now, let me flip back to the previous slide. The previous slide, I flipped such a cell. You see in the middle here? Here's a domain wall between minus and plus. And this cell that I put a little black dot in is definitely type G because it has a connected interface with plus and a connected interface with minus. And notice that if we go ahead and form G bar, if we flip that cell over to the plus regime, then what it does is it bulges the domain wall. And in topological terms, we call that an isotopy. We've moved the domain wall continuously. And now what the Hamiltonian says about that operation is that in order to be accorded zero energy under that projector, under this projector, we have to have equal coefficients on that G and G bar configuration. Because when we project onto the vector G minus G bar, that's this vector going down at 45 degrees, the kernel of that projection is anything proportional to G plus G bar. Notice these have the same coefficient. So being zero, so in other words, what we're doing is we're imposing a relation. You can read G minus G bar equals zero as the relation G equals G bar. But in physics, you don't actually have the notion of quotient space. Instead, you have the notion of perp. So we have to do it this backhanded way. Okay, we have to, in topologically, what we're trying to do is impose an equivalence relation up to isotopy. But the way to do it in physics language is to force yourself to be perpendicular to a relation. And the relation is spanned by vectors of this kind.
It's going to have the effect that if you act on a state with domain wall and you remove the domain wall, you get the same energy.
Yes. In fact, the way to say it is anything that's in the ground state of this, just look at this, will be equally superimposed. Yes, yes.
Equal weight superposition of all the configurations of the domain wall.
All that are within the same isotopy class. If you're on a torus or something, there are different isotopy classes, and they can have their own weights. But if two domain walls differ by an isotopy, to be in the ground state, they must be weighted equally.
You can never. This operation will never cause domain walls that were not in the sex physics.
Yes, no, it will never change the topology of domain walls, and that's precisely because I excluded these configurations from type G. They're not type G because they. If you see, notice that if you did flip the central hexagon here, you would perform a surgery.
Right.
You would change the topology. Is that clear? If you have a domain wall that's like this with the central hexagon in here, and you flip it, then the domain wall looks like that. I guess it looked like that to begin with. There we go. Okay. So the domain wall, so this is a non-G configuration because we go plus, minus, plus, minus instead of having connected intervals of interface with the two different signs.
So this is another
Is the domain wall where a string in your head's real tension?
I don't know what that means.
That's right.
And
no interaction.
Yeah, this is exactly.
No tension, no interaction.
Oh, you're right. Yes, you're right. It doesn't care about the length of the domain wall yet. It will. Let's look at the next term. The next term will tend to tighten up these domain walls. That's the H term. So the H term, remember H states were the ones that lived in a sea of similar sign? So what happens when you flip the sign, when you bar an H state? What happens is you create a new circle of domain wall, a hexagon, in fact. Okay? Now, being perpendicular to this vector, the very bottom, I don't know if that can be read so low, but the first term says that you must be perpendicular to H minus 1 over the golden number, that's about 0.6. H minus 0.6 H bar, so that's a vector like this. Being perpendicular to that means proportional to H plus 1.61 times H bar. So that means that if you consider two states which are identical, two classical states are identical, except one of them has a small circle born in it, that one is preferred by the Hamiltonian in the mixture, in the superposition of the ground state. That one will have 1.6 times the coefficient of the one that didn't have the circle. So to summarize these two properties, I say the second term in the Hamiltonian is democracy of isotopy, isotopy democracy. All isotopic states enter equally. And the second term is H-bar-like circles. That is, a typical snapshot of the ground state will be rich with circles.
Well, it's the only way of creating the window.
What?
This is the only way of creating or annihilating the window.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes, that's right.
If you start on something which has no domain walls, this term creates the domain walls.
Right, right. So in fact, I'll use the term later on in the talk, generalized isotopy class, where by that I just mean the important part of the picture moves by isotopy, but trivial circles are allowed to appear and disappear.
So, I mean, if you had just this term, there'd be eigenstates which had sort of the max dense packet of circles.
Suppose you look at a ground state vector of H0, it'll be a superposition of many classical states, right? But the classical states that will have the most mass are the ones that are filled with a foam, sort of maximally filled with little circles, because each little circle counts for 1.6 extra in their coefficient. So you'll have very low weight on configurations that have here's the string tension. If you have a very long wiggly domain wall, it's eating up bonds of this hexagonal picture and reducing the possible number of closed circles that can be squeezed in. So every 6 bonds you waste by spiraling around or something means that some circle that could have been there is not there. So the weight on that particular component
so
of the
disfavored.
It likes foam.
Yeah.
And there's a very interesting, there's an interesting competition between energy and entropy here.
Yeah, of arbitrary coefficients.
Yeah, we could. I don't know. Yeah, I took one because I don't know any better. But if you want to change.
But your algebraic methods work for any coefficients?
Yes.
So presumably there could be phase transitions as well.
I know the ground state exactly. Don't allow that.
Why?
Because I want this form to be positive semi-definite. That's key to the analysis of it. Okay. Well, I said that it's a sum of this sum is not a projector itself.
It's not commutative.
They're not commutative. But this is a sum of projectors onto one-dimensional spaces. Like any positive coefficients, you can correctly make the statement I'm going to make, which is that the ground state is the temporary Lie algebra. So
no matter what the coefficient,
as long as they're positive.
Is that observation which restricts D to be the golden mean, or something else?
Before we get to the perturbation,
right,
the golden number will not play an important role.
Right.
But the golden number plays an important role when we discuss the perturbation theory.
Okay.
Okay. So
right now D is arbitrary.
D is arbitrary right now, but it.
Can I just make sure I understand? So H0 moves around when it acts on your state with a line on it, that line starts moving around, is that right? Because you
that term moves.
H0, moves the line around.
And yeah. Creates new circles.
And epsilon creates new circles, is that?
I haven't even discussed epsilon at all. I forgot in my excitement, I forgot to address this line at all. Eventually, we'll talk about a perturbation, and the simplest possible perturbation would just be the Pauli matrix sigma x acting on each site. So there'd be some small amplitude for flipping between plus spin and minus spin, irregardless of the type. Okay, just some noise. And I want to eventually discuss the effect of a perturbation on the ground state. Yes?
So how much is the dimension of the
ground state? I have numbers, and they're coming up like in 6 transparencies, if you can hold off. Yeah, because when I talk about these highly degenerate ground states, people naturally want to know how highly, what are the numbers, and I will show them to you. So a pleasant digression is coming. In order to understand the ground states of both the unperturbed and the perturbed operator, I need to explain this temporary lead category, and I need to explain its very rigid algebraic structure. And I just want to go over the notion, since this is a physics audience, of an ideal, okay? So an ideal, just like an ordinary algebra, is going to be some collection of things, and because it's a category, the things will be morphisms. You'll see pictures of them on the next slide, or slide after next. It's a collection of things which are closed under an internal plus, which is a formal operation that physicists are very comfortable with. It's just like formal linear combination. And it should be externally closed under times and tensor product. This algebra has two multiplications. It has the ordinary times and it's a tensor algebra. You can tensor things as well. And externally closed means if something's in the ideal and you times it by anything, whether it's in the ideal or not, the result is back in the ideal. You should think of an even number. If you take an even number and multiply it by 7, it's still even. Now, there's a remarkable theorem due to Goodman and Wenzel, which the rest of the talk will rely on, and here's the first place the golden number comes in. If you take the tensor category, temporary lead, at the golden number, then this tensor category has a unique non-trivial ideal. And when you divide out by this ideal, you get a C-star algebra, which is this Drinfield double. And again, my thesis is written here. I believe that the perturbed ground state will have the structure of a quotient category, so we'll be able to identify it with this favorable C-star algebra. Now,
are you going to go on the, is that it?
No. No, I want to try to make you comfortable by analogy first, with the idea that locality should have something to do with algebra. Okay. So, what is locality in physics? You're all comfortable with the idea of locality. It's very central. What is locality in algebra? I claim it's nothing more than the notion of ideal, because suppose you have an integer and you write it down its factorization. How do you tell whether it's even? That's the simplest case of an ideal, is the integer is even. Well, you look through at these factors, and as soon as you find one that's 2, then you're done. No more argument. You don't have to look at the rest. It's a local test to see whether something is even. Now, in perturbation theory, it may be, in some cases, expected that if you have a stable phase, that it can be defined by some local system of projectors operating on some previously constructed approximation space. And an example of this from the quantum Hall effect is the odd fraction denominator Landau levels, Laughlin states. If you consider just the states of a single electron in a two-dimensional system in the presence of a magnetic field, then you find its energy levels computed by Landau levels, and if you regard now the introduction of a Coulomb interaction between many electrons as sort of a, quote, perturbation on the Landau level, then you find that the reduction in the ground state from the Landau level to the odd fraction state is given by a family of local projectors where you project out certain relative angular momentums between pairs of particles. This is from a paper of Reed and Resnais. So I hope it's not implausible that perturbation theory could be addressed by algebra, because perturbation theory may be controlled by local projectors and algebra discusses ideals.
So that requires some
hypotheses like gap and
some structure to the ground state.
I'm not saying this is a panacea for analyzing physical states, though I hope the method may have some wide applicability. But in this case, my Hamiltonian is rooted sort of in topology. I mean, I've built isotropy into the notion, into the Hamiltonian H0, so I sort of built in this algebra. And so it's not going to be unreasonable that its perturbation theory will be controlled by ideals within that algebra. So let me just tell you what the temporary lead algebra is. I've used the word many times without giving a picture for it. Temporary lead is, these are the names of physicists, at least temporally. Leib's kind of on the borderline. But they didn't actually come up with this pictorial description. They did all the hard work, and they left it to Von Jones and Lou Kaufman, each of whom credit the other for drawing these lovely pictures. So in category you have objects, and here the objects are just some finite number of points on an interval, these black dots, and morphisms, and morphisms go between objects. In the temporary lead category, the morphisms are just diagrams you can draw which pair the points, and the diagrams have to be drawn in a rectangle. So they're just systems of embedded arcs which don't cross, which pair up the points, like as in this example. And plus is just a formal operation. It's just superposition, and you can take, you know, complex coefficients. So this makes it, these diagrams a vector space over the complex numbers. Times is vertical stacking. If you have two diagrams, you can try to stack them one on top of the other and make a new diagram. So this upper rectangle is one diagram, one morphism, and here's another morphism. And in this case, they're composed, and you get a third morphism. Now notice that you can't hope to compose unless something matches up. You have to have the same number of output points for the top one as input points for the bottom one, otherwise it makes no sense to match them. And that's the sense in which this is called a category rather than an algebra. So if you're not familiar with that terminology, just relax. Just think of a category as an algebra where sometimes you're not allowed to multiply. It's not defined.
So you want the objects have any number of dots?
Or any number of dots. So like here's four and here's six. Any finite number. The algebra only works if it's the same number of dots, and then it's a graded.
Right?
Yeah, and then it's a graded algebra. You have an algebra for seven dots, eight dots, nine dots. You have all these, and these graded algebras fit together.
But you can multiply 7 to 16, 16 to 22. Frank rectangular.
You mean by multiple? Oh.
I think he's describing the category of vector, finite dimensional vector spaces.
But
the analog.
I mean, I can think of those as the sizes of a rectangle.
Oh, yes, yes, I agree. I agree with you, exactly. But what you can't do is you can't multiply two rectangular matrices if there's a mismatch between, I don't know, the height of this one and the length of that one. I forget how you multiply. The length of that one and the height of that one. Right.
The range of one has to be.
Exactly. That's what's going on here. So that's another example of a category where composition is sometimes sensible and sometimes not. Now, I picked an example of times here where something interesting happened. That is, a closed circle was created, and when I stuck this rectangle onto this rectangle, a closed circle emerged, and there had been none previously. So this is where the subscript D comes in. Remember, the objects in the category, or the morphisms in the category, have no closed circles, so we have to know what to do about this embarrassment that we got a closed circle. And then what we do is we just erase it, it's gone, but then we multiply the diagram by the numerical factor D. And that's why the category has this parameter D in it.
Sorry, but what does multiply mean
now? Well, remember these are formal combinations over C.
Ah.
So these diagrams actually appear with coefficients, arbitrary coefficients. And then there's another time structure here, which is the tensor product, which is just horizontal stacking of rectangles. I don't have to stack them top to bottom, I can stack them left to right, and I get what's called a tensor operation, which adds grades, so to speak. It adds the number of inputs here to the number of inputs here and adds outputs.
There's no restriction on that because there's no dots and things to match up, so that's...
There's no restriction on tensor product.
Ordinary.
Exactly.
It's just like tensor product on matrices.
Where are the grades?
There are no braids in the temporary Lieb algebra exactly, but there's a homomorphism from the braid group into the temporary Lieb algebra using the Kaufman relation. If you see a braid like this, you can resolve this as A plus 1 over A inverse for the two resolutions. So there's where A is some root of unity. So there are interesting homomorphisms related to D. So there are interesting homomorphisms of the braid group into the temporal algebra, even though these are planar pictures. Now, the temporal Lieb algebra has a beautiful pairing called Markov trace. And here it is in a nutshell. If you have two morphisms in the category, you can kind of bend their rectangles and stick them together into an annulus. So think of taking this and bending it 180 degrees, and it becomes this picture. And thinking of this one and bending it, so 180 degree bend. I'm bending this and this into a horseshoe. This is bent into a right-facing horseshoe, and this is bent into a left-facing horseshoe. Here, this annulus is two horseshoes. and I've reproduced the two pictures.
See, what are the any rules here?
Well, it's just a physical thing. I mean, you have this rectangle with this, these arches.
I've done this picture, but I wouldn't know how to.
Well, okay, the more technical thing is you take this thing and you turn it upside down. You reflect it in this, and then you multiply this composed with that. And then you do what's called trace, where you you connect like that. But that's the same as bending them and sticking them together. And then this is the definition of the pairing on a basis.
But this pairs only things with the same number.
Yeah. So the pairing, just like in, yeah, it's a little annoyance as before, that you can't always pair things.
So is that all the category is?
Basically. In algebra, you can't, yeah.
You can't always.
Yeah, but, you know, as physicists, we're not in luck in this regard. Because even though there's nothing at all to category theory, you have to learn two category theory now to do physics.
You have to learn
two
categories?
Yeah.
What does that mean? You have to learn
plane algebra. I think you have to learn about two categories, where you have two levels of morphisms. This guy, John Baez, who is at Irvine, is one of the exponents of this. You should have him up and give you a talk on how to do physics by two categories. But no. But even to do Chern-Simons theory, you have to, at some point, you have to get into two categories, and even three.
So, but what's the N category mean? So,
well, the simple, here's the simplest example of is suppose you have manifold, a target manifold dimension N. And now the objects might be maps of points into it, and then the morphism between the objects might be maps of arcs connecting two points. And now suppose you have two arcs sitting there, a map of a rectangle between them would be a two morphism. And now suppose you have two of those connecting by a cube, that's a three morphism. So that's the simplest, and that makes it sound like it's not hard to understand multi-categories, that it's no different than cell complexes. But it's that part is false. this one example is easy. So I'm afraid I'm boring the C-star algebraists at this point, but this is really an important thing. This pairing extends from the basis elements by linearity, actually, linear in this and Hermitian linear in this coordinate, to give you a to give you some kind of Hermitian pairing from the category, comma, the category into the complex numbers. And this pairing is actually definite if that integer, if that real number d is 2 or greater. And if the integer is less than 2, the pairing is usually quite mixed. It has negative directions and positive directions. It's real mess. But there's a discrete set of values less than 2, which are of the form 2 cosine pi over an integer. These are the magic numbers. 2 cosine pi over m. If d is equal to these values, then it turns out that this pairing is positive semi-definite. It has zero directions but no negative directions. The zero directions are called the radical. Rd. My case here, m is 5. If m is 5, this is the golden number. It turns out the radical is always generated by one element. It's a principal ideal. And in fact, it's the only ideal in this algebra by that theorem of Goodman and Wenzel. It's generated by one element, which can be worked out in this kind of Chinese character notation. So The important case for me when d is golden number, m is 5, it turns out this is a theory. Physically, this corresponds to a theory with four particle types: the trivial particle, the one particle, the two particle, the three particle. There is no four particle in this theory. And what this projector relation shows is how the four particle decomposes into a sum of 13 simpler particles. So if you think of this four strands as some, you know, particle of weight 4 moving up to bottom, this gives you...
What do you mean by a particle?
Well, I thought you'd like that. Okay, you're the particle physicist. So, okay, in these, okay, David. In these, so, I don't know.
You're just saying you could.
No, this terminology has some coherence. That is, in this theory of PQFTs and modular functors, there are these label types. There's this finite dimensional set of representations.
Yeah. What's a radical?
So the radical, that's just algebraic terminology. The radical is just the elements that pair trivially. So
that means if you have four lines, you can replace it by that constant.
Exactly, in the quotient. So if X belongs to RD, then this pairing of X with anything equals zero. This is sometimes called the negligible elements, this radical.
This relation, and you're allowed to replace four guys
by simpler pictures. Yeah,
you should never have more than four lines.
Never more than three, because you can think of four on the left side and it falls apart. So what this means is, if you're familiar with the terminology of labels in the PQFT, the labels are supposed to be the particles, and these are the representations of the loop group or the representations of the quantum group that parameterize the theory. These theories are sort of indexed by knowing how many particle types there are, what their fusion and braiding matrices are. And this is a theory with four particle types, counting the trivial particle. And this is, you can work out this relation, and it's an amazing thing that this superposition of 14, so this is something in the temporary Lieb algebra, going from 4 to 4. It's a superposition of 14 terms, with these coefficients, these real number coefficients. And it's an amazing thing. Well, first, that it is in the radical.
I guess, I'm wrong. This is the example of D equals the golden mean?
Yes, which is the only example I'm going to treat from now on.
Which is
the simplest universal, exactly.
And, okay. And if you're chosen, let's say D equals 2, would
it
have been
2 trivial? Yes, that's right. I get a theory. The relation there would be the relation would just look like this minus this equals zero. That's the relation for D equals 2, which is essentially the thing that would be introduced by the perturbation sigma X.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in particular, you wouldn't have gotten any.
That's right. Yeah, this would be homology theory. So I think it's worth just, we'll come back to this picture in a minute.
It's worth commenting that this is what you get from the three-state dots model.
That leads to the same theory.
The formal field theory.
Uh-huh.
Three-state dots
model. I see. Okay. That sounds consistent with what I know.
Or for other people in the room, it's one of the discrete series of conformal field theory. It's C less than 1. It's the one after the Ising model.
It's the one.
You have one okay. 6 right. Over mm-hmm. P plus 1. What you want to do is you want to take P equals 5.
So just to emphasize geometrically what this means, to say that this element P4 is in the radical, let's just think of some way of pairing it with something. So the simplest thing to picture would be maybe this trace pairing, where you just take four lines and close them around. So what it, in particular, the statement specializes to the fact that if you patiently do all 14 terms and see what numerical value you get. So this one, you close around like that and you see four circles. That means golden number to the fourth, that term becomes. This one, you close around and it becomes, it looks like two circles. So it's golden number squared. This one, I don't know, you know, and then there are these coefficients. You add all that up, you get zero. And that would be true for any closure you took, not just that simple trace closure. So that says that this is in the radical, but the amazing statement is that this generates the radical. And the further amazing statement,
it's somehow related to a null state that's defined by the model.
I'm not sure about that.
How did you?
You can certainly immediately recognize.
It's kind of recognizable from the numerics. I mean, all these have an integer parameter and they.
No, I mean, you can interpret all of these, you can interpret these four labels in terms of primary fields and then formal field theory and all of this grading and set. Grading is well known from the formal
field theory. So, I mean, in-state plots model comes from such a theory at d equals 2 plus pi over n plus 2.
And, well, yeah.
So you have more complicated such relations.
So just try to remember this picture while as I go on, okay?
And the most amazing fact is...
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, I forgot. Well, so there's a succession of increasingly amazing facts. The first thing is that this superposition of pictures is in the radical. That's kind of the fact we just discussed. The second is it generates the radical. Every other picture can be made by stacking something either to the left or right or up or down from this picture. So in other words, this picture occurs as a sub-picture of anything in the radical, even in the big category with 90 strands. You know, you don't have to take four strands. You can have any number of strands. If something's in the radical, you can find a little box in that complicated superposition of pictures that looks like that.
Now you're going to tell us what that means. It's just going to be written as this.
Well, no. It's... So anyway, that's the second. And the third thing, which is even more amazing, is that this radical is the only ideal in the category. You see, the radical is certainly an ideal because if you have something that pairs trivially with anything, then certainly if you multiply it by something else, it retains the property of pairing trivially with anything because this is just another example of a possible thing to pair it with. So the radical is an ideal, and the most amazing fact is this is the only ideal in the category.
It generates the radical.
It generates the radical, and that radical which it generates is the unique ideal in the category. So it's a local category.
A local thing that generates everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe this is, you know, what's very significant for the physics. So we're actually pretty close to the end. I appreciate your patience with this. So this whole discussion of the temporary lead category can be globalized and put on any surface with boundary. You know, right now it's kind of rigidly stacking rectangles up, down, left, right. But you can imagine these diagrams of lines can curve around on any surface. And the notion of ideal still persists. It just corresponds to something that can be recognized in a small spot on the surface. Something is in the ideal if it, something is in an ideal if the ideal generated by a picture on a disk are those pictures on a big surface that, when restricted to the disk, are that picture. Since multiplication is stacking, factoring is restriction, you know, by the analogy with integers. So an ideal is something that, an ideal generated by X, is where X is a picture on a disk, are those pictures on a surface so that when you look at some disk, you see X.
You know, actually, that quotient on the surface with boundary is the same as the algebra of functions on the appropriate group. I think it's SL3C or something like that.
I didn't know that. Okay, we should talk about that. So,
it's in compute draw, maybe illustrate that, what you just said.
Well, yeah, actually that's sort of my... Actually, I have that on my last transparency. Do you want? Should we just wait till it comes, or do you want to do it now? Here's a preview. So, if you have some configuration which I haven't drawn on a general surface, so configuration, black lines, domain walls on the surface, and you have something on a disk. For example, P4, that's that complicated thing that was up just recently, then you would say, by extension of the notion of ideal when we were stacking rectangles, you'd say that this picture was in the ideal generated by P4 if, when you restricted the superposition of pictures to this disk, you saw those 14 terms with those coefficients. That's the correct notion in the surface, what Vaughan would call the surface algebra. That's the correct generalization of ideal to a surface algebra.
But the is that then, can that be then paired with something which is...
Well, the pairing is much more subtle now. You can't pair into the complex numbers, you can pair into some modular functor of a closed surface. There's a more complicated target for the pairing, but I won't be using properties of the pairing between surfaces with topology. But there is some pairing, but it's more subtle.
Because otherwise, what does it mean to be in the idea?
Well,
that surface.
It doesn't make much sense to be in the negligible maps anymore, but it still makes sense to be in the ideal. See, we found the ideal by considering the things that were killed by the pairing, but once we have the notion of the ideal, we can go and run with that, and we don't need to discuss the pairing any further.
I guess the question. Yes, what is the ideal good for?
Ah, it's unique. The theorem of Goodman and Wenzel will still apply in the surface category.
You see, any time you have a system of closed curves on the surface, you can map the functions on the modulized space to match connections by taking the holonomy. And certain combinations of curves will go to the zero function. So now you can map into that space instead of into complex numbers. And you can ask yourself, what is the kernel of that map? And that's generated by certain local relations. This is what I said.
So this is just, I'll just say this very quickly, this is just terminology. I'm putting S over temporary lead means we're considering the surface situation, so temporary lead category on a surface. And E is just a technical condition. If it's domain walls that work up, that give rise to our one manifolds, only even pictures occur. That is, for instance, on a torus, you would never see a single meridian curve as a domain wall. They'd come in pairs. So we have something which is the even temporal loop category on the surface, and it can be characterized as the span of pictures which are deformable by isotopy, but it's generalized isotopy because, remember, in the temporal loop category, there's a rule for dealing with small circles. You can kill them at the expense of multiplying by the golden number. But that was exactly what we built into our Hamiltonian, H0. So it's sort of a tautology that the ground state of the Hamiltonian, H0, is the even temporary Lieb surface algebra. It's sort of tautological. The Hamiltonian was designed to produce that as its ground state. It knows the same equivalence relations as isotopy and generalized isotopy. So if you remember
the... ground state is the algebra.
Well, don't worry about the algebraic structure. Underneath, because that algebra has to do with gluing the surfaces. Just think of it as a vector space. On the vector space level, this algebra is just, in a topological point of view, it's equivalence classes of pictures up to isotopy and a certain rule for birth and death of circles. And not in the quotient context, but in the perp context, we isolated that same space as the zero vectors of the Hamiltonian. We built the Hamiltonian that way.
So the dimension of the Hilbert space is given by the Fallegian numbers?
After some quotient. This will be related to Verlinde numbers. We'll come to that. Okay. So what I want to say is that
the uniqueness that's everything. So
this is a rather big thing. This temporary Lieb algebra. I mean, the next slide will have a picture of it. But what I want you to simultaneously think of is the quotient object, where we divide out by the radical. And this is a much smaller thing. This is the modular category. And this is something that with collaborators, I've worked out exactly the representations associated. So this is something that's really infinite dimensional, and this quotient is finite dimensional. Let me illustrate with this picture. The temporary Lieb thing is on the top here. I've taken some rather simple surface, a disk with four punctures, and a rather simple division into upspins and downspins. Inside the red circle, everything's spinning up, and outside the red circle, everything's spinning down. Now I execute some kind of braiding where I move this puncture around and about, slide these two over, and finally bring that puncture to here. So some braiding transforms this kind of convex oval into this wiggly shape, okay? And again, I still have the spins going up and the spins going down here. Now this represents the action of the braid group on the temporary Lieb algebra, because it's moving this picture of circles. And it's readily seen from this picture that this algebra is infinite dimensional, and that the action is going to move you off toward infinity, because as you start grading these things, the thickness, you know, the number of red dots that a typical ray will cross will grow exponentially as you, you know, act on it by words in this braid group. So this is a huge thing. But notice in the presence of the projector relation, namely in the quotient algebra, this C star algebra, which I write as D, this is finite dimensional. Nothing very complicated can happen, because as soon as you've braided it a certain amount, you see four lines running parallel. And remember, the import of the Wenzel relation, the P4 relation, was that that can be decomposed into a superposition of 13 terms. Here's one of them, all of which are simpler. You recouple transverse to that dotted line. So it's quite clear from looking at that picture that the quotient is finite dimensional. And then there was a question of exactly what the dimensions are. And here they are. Again, what I would say is the ground state for the Hamiltonian H0 is not literally the temporary leap surface algebra, because there's no cutoff in the abstract surface algebra. It can have a billion lines parallel to each other. But I described the Hamiltonian that was on a specific lattice model, so there's certainly a cutoff. But if you want to know, you know, how big the thing is in the presence of the cutoff, well, G0i is highly degenerate. It's very big. And if the Betti number of the surface is just the number of punctures, if it's in the plane, and if it's, you have a surface with B punctures and V vertices, because it depends on the triangulation, then the dimension of the temporary lead category in this finite model is, there's some topological term, this is where the Verlinde number comes in, it's like the square, it's roughly the square of the B Fibonacci number. It's a square, because this turns out to be a double.
I was thinking more of the quotient space.
No, yeah, well, here, this is, okay. It's this thing which is in the quotient, times something which is topologically meaningless, which is a polynomial in the number of vertices. But this polynomial is actually a huge thing. Its degree is an exponential function of the Betti number B. So there's the, even in, with the finite cutoff, G0 is much bigger by this polynomial factor, polynomial in the number of vertices should be thought of as the refinement scale of the problem, or maybe the square of the refinement scale. Now, the quotient is a topological thing, and that's related to the Verlinde numbers. And there it is some Fibonacci number. That's the dimension, and that's independent of the triangulation, and that's the candidate for the perturbed ground state. So with that sort of digression into algebra, we kind of come to the most important point, which is, why should the quotient algebra be the perturbed ground state? So in perturbation theory, what you do is, you know, again, modulo assumptions that the ground state has some gap, and all these are very shaky in this context, but let's just kind of plow ahead formally. What you do is you look at the way some perturbation V will act on the unperturbed ground state, what its effective action is at order K, and you go through the orders until you find some non-trivial effective action, and basically you stop when you find the first non-trivial effective action. Now, what should we picture the perturbation doing? I think the easiest thing topologically to picture perturbation doing is allowing a surgery. So in other words, it allows this configuration to change to this, which is typically what a sigma x will do. And this is called, this little picture in here, this vector is called a skein relation. It's a linear combination of local pictures. And as you look at these kth derivatives, you see increasing powers of the perturbation. And what happens is the skein pictures that occur in increasing powers are more and more complicated skein diagrams. Now, that P4 that we ran into a few slides back, the thing with the 14 terms, that occurs at third order of perturbation theory, because all the various pictures differ from the straight through picture by at most three little surgeries. So that'll occur when K is equal to 3. Now, if we take our ansatz, and this is rather a strong one, and this is weaker, but it's shorter to argue from the strong one, so let me focus on that.
You're not saying that P4 factors in terms of skein relations.
I'm saying P4 is a skein relation. I'm thinking of P4 as a skein relation, which will occur in the cube of this perturbation. You see,
in the first term, this is a skein relation.
But too small a one. so let's think what the problem with being too small is. So let me just read the ansatz. I'm going to assume, and this is, you know, we can argue whether it's a good assumption, I'm going to assume that the perturbed ground state is the joint null space of some local system of projectors acting on the original ground state. Now, from that ansatz, it's a sort of a slam dunk. It's just tautology, what the quotient is. The point is that if the order of perturbation is less than 3, then any local system of projectors, any skein relation, skein relation is a synonym for local system of projectors because it's specified in the chart in the small and it's general in the complement, which is exactly what it means for a projector to be local. In physics, for a projector to be local, you have a group, a small clump of degrees of freedom in which you choose a projector and then it's tensor the identity on the rest. So if the order is less than 3, then any local system of projectors will span a complete set of directions on G0. That's saying that that element in the algebra generates the whole algebra as the ideal. This is the import of P4 being the first thing that's complicated enough not to give the whole algebra. So if you take a look at first or second order in perturbation theory, any system of projectors that arise spans the whole space and does not give a candidate for the quotient because there's no perp to it. So the first candidate for a quotient occurs at order 3. Well, candidate for the quotient.
You're perturbing the ground state.
Right. So I'm taking the model. If you go back in your mind to the transparency where I showed the Laughlin odd denominator state as defined within the Landau level by the joint null state of the family of relative angular momentum projectors. Okay, that's kind of the model you should think of. What I'm assuming, and this is the ansatz, we can argue about its applicability, because certainly many hypotheses would have to come into this, like gap and so on. But what I'm assuming is that the unperturbed ground state has some operator derived from the perturbation acting on it, and that this operator is that the perturbed ground state can be described as the joint null space of local projectors acting on the unperturbed ground state.
I understand, but why is that the projective space?
Sorry, projective space?
Why is that this quotient space that you're...
Why is it the quotient space?
Yeah. Isn't it dependent on which projector?
Yeah, but the point, that's the uniqueness of the ideal. There's only one choice, only one... See, when you say a local projector, it's not one projector. It's a huge family of projectors, because local means it's defined somewhere and then arbitrary in the complement. So go back to the example of the even numbers being an ideal. If it's 2 here and arbitrary in the complement, then it's the ideal of even numbers. So if it's some skein relation here and arbitrary in the complement, that's what local means, it's going to be some ideal in the temporary Lieb algebra, and there's only one ideal, and it occurs at order 3. So the first candidate for the ansatz is the Markov trace radical. Yeah, and that arises at the...
Exactly.
No. I mean, all kinds of things arise in the perturbation theory, and most of them can't affect the ground state because they generate projector onto a complete set of directions. So you have this ground state for H0. You have this ground state for H0, what I'm calling G0, and most things that arise in perturbation theory are sums of projectors on a complete set of directions.
And that's manifold.
In this linear space.
But there must be things that arise.
But the model for perturbation theory is you're looking for the effective action of a perturbation on the unperturbed ground state. And the ansatz I'm taking is that the action will be the form of local projectors. Okay? I mean, so in other words, what I'm hypothesizing is that we can analyze the perturbed ground state as a subspace of the unperturbed one and defined by local projectors.
Local projectors within that subspace?
Yes. Well, but actually, the projector can be out of the subspace, but then it amounts to taking the projection of the vector into the subspace and perp to that.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Are you saying that P4 license, I'm thinking of sort of a silly theory where I'm allowed to do crossing chains once on two slots or on three slots. Are you saying that if you apply a local relation for something like this, it's equal to something like that, if you apply that in three independent places?
Yeah, you could make P4.
You get P4.
You might make P4. You might make a million other things, okay? But I'm saying if you take any one of those other million things you take, that's sort of a term in V cubed, in the perturbation cubed. And when you regard that as a system of projectors, why a system? Because this is a local picture and it can be extended by an arbitrary state on the outside. When you regard it as a system of projectors, it completely spans the unperturbed ground state. So it does not give a candidate perp. It does not give...
Right, it gives zero as perp.
It gives zero as perp, so there's no candidate for the new null space. The null space of the effective action of the perturbation is zero. Just not even one dimensional, it's just dead zero, so there's no candidate.
But for k higher than 3 or something, you get...
As soon as you get to, it is just one thing. I mean, it's because of this uniqueness theorem. As you pass through all the cases, once some non-trivial thing pops in, and that's what... And the non-trivial thing that pops in is P4. As soon as P4 occurs, then that spans this radical RD, and its perp is exactly this modular category that's then the model for the ground state.
And how do you know you don't get something more than, how do you know you don't kill the perp of that too?
Now, why don't you get the trivial ideal, which is the whole space?
Because then the ground state would be zero dimensional.
Right.
That doesn't happen.
Unique? No.
It could be one dimensional.
Well, you'd have all.
No,
one-dimensional.
Not one. If you take a space and divide by itself, you don't get a one-dimensional space. You get a zero-dimensional space. So now I will admit. Let me make an admission, because all this sounds like magic. This whole discussion is a little bit like looking under the lamppost for your keys. It's because the algebra is so powerful that I believe in the ansatz that the algebra tells the story. I mean, you could say, why should the ground state be defined by local projectors? Why isn't it more complicated than the Laughlin denominator state? And all this can be discussed, and it depends, whether it's a reasonable model may depend on whether you can argue that there are energy gaps in the thermodynamic limit for these Hamiltonians. I mean, there's a whole discussion there.
That's what's about it, in the fire. You're using local...
In two senses.
Yeah, in two senses. And
But they're the same.
Clearly, for this Hilbert space in this Hamiltonian, you've written Hamiltonian with a degeneracy of space which goes like the following, right? Degeneracy.
No, the original, went much bigger, it was polynomial in the volume, remember? That was...
It was a polynomial, it wasn't linear.
No, it was polynomial in the volume, yeah.
Okay,
you remember. I don't know, it's some polynomial in the volume.
Sure. And now you want to cut that down.
Right.
And you want to cut it down, however, to an enormous...
Yeah, it's still a big space. That's going to be the computational space. Yeah.
That's what you need to use. Whereas, but I would understand what the assumption is that cuts it down, because I obviously could add a perturbation that picks out a sequence.
A very small perturbation?
And obviously, I could do that by picking out a small Hamiltonian that had a unique ground state.
Would this Hamiltonian
be
local? It wouldn't be local.
Well, even locally, I imagine. I can't believe it.
No, I think that's what
maybe it's not a sum of projection operators locally. But that must be the basic thing. I can't believe
it. Just put a source for these strings. They'll want to collide.
Right.
Get sucked into the source.
I can't believe that locally I can't pick out a unique ground state for this function. So it's got to be not just locality space.
Yeah.
But also the assumption that they all
constructed
out of something, which I didn't exactly understand.
Right. So the assumption that I was arguing from is that the perturbed ground state would be defined.
That's your assumption about the ground state.
No, but
what is your assumption about the
perturbation?
Well,
it's impossible to fathom you know, rigorously how a given perturbation will act on this ground state. So instead of making an assumption about the perturbation, I'm making an assumption about the way the perturbation will act on the ground state. It's indirect. And in a physical context, we don't have control of this perturbation. I mean, that's the reason.
You're not saying that this particular perturbation.
No, no. This is an example. I'm not. I'm just saying this is the kind of perturbation I'm imagining, and the ansatz is that whatever the perturbation is, the way it's going to pick out the new ground state is within the original ground state by a sum of projectors, or one can argue from a slightly more general proposition that it's a positive linear combination of such projectors rather than just a joint null space. And I think it would take, there's some dividing line between mathematics and charlatanism here, you know, which we're getting very close to. But on the other hand,
there's a mathematical intuition here that's
the lamppost intuition, right? Looking under
the ideal is this stable unique thing,
right? So that
it's sort of the only naturally defined unique object.
Exactly.
But I don't see the physical intuition that there is something that protects you from just getting
which
often happens. Usually
right. So,
I mean, from the Tambellini point of view, you can see the P, you know, as being the curve of the joint space construction, you know, on the level of the Tambellini algebra. You actually have two ideals in the Tambellini algebra. One is the previous Tambellini algebra, you know, generated by the joint projection, and the previous one, and the higher one. And that's a two-sided ideal. I mean, to take the torsion, then the PK.
But what David is arguing is why this discussion of perps of ideals is relevant to the physics. I mean, he buys the discussion about perps of ideals, I think. But,
that I don't know.
I'd like your help with this, you know, rather than adversarial. In other words, what I see is this beautiful algebraic model for what perturbation theory should settle down to, and it follows from a formal ansatz.
Yeah, but physically, you usually say there's some. You know, we start very simple Hamiltonian, which is enormous degeneracy, and then we say, well, this isn't exact, but there's still some.
I understand. I have a good answer. I know it's bothering you, and I can answer it. What I need to explain. For example, let's just look at the perturbation, this one, summation of sigma v x, okay? Let's turn on this perturbation, and what this does is this tends to superimpose all the classical states. If this was the only term in the Hamiltonian, the lowest eigenvector would be the one that was mixed, it superimposed equally in all states, right? So you might think of it in the Hilbert space as the diagonal vector in this basis. That's the ground state, okay? So now let's see why turning on this perturbation, why the structure of the temporary Lieb algebra resists finding this as the new ground state, okay? It'll actually abhor this state. And the reason is because suppose here's a classical configuration and you start doing local surgeries on it, okay? According to this term is very happy with doing all these local surgeries or not doing them because it's trying to form this superposition of all these states equally. Mm-hmm. So this vector is all these perturbed states equally. But in the Hamiltonian, these states, in the ground state of the main term, these states are weighted exponentially differently because this Hamiltonian looks at how many trivial circles there are in the picture, and it takes 1.6 and raises it to the number of those circles, and the coefficients differ. So the overlap between the diagonal vector in the Hilbert space and any ground state vector is actually exponentially small in the refinement scale. So I think some intuition comes from that. I mean, this sort of explains why this simple skein relation does not generate a non-trivial ideal in the algebra. this is, it sort of goes nearly orthogonally to the algebra. And the beautiful fact, and this is why it's a deep theorem of Goodman and Wenzel, is it's not just this one thing that'll go exponentially close to orthogonal. Anything you can think of except P4 will go exponentially close to orthogonal. So that at least says why the most obvious perturbation won't coax this huge ground state into being this one-dimensional candidate.
But there are perturbations. I think Greg had an example of one that tend to shrink the surface to nothing.
That won't happen in the regime of a perturbation, because there's a very powerful term in the main term. The main Hamiltonian loves circles. The main term likes circles.
A long way to get to that.
Look, puncture a hole in your surface.
Yeah.
And pull it down so it looks like a funnel. I mean, it's an old stuff there. Fall into the hole.
No, that's not translationally invariant.
Yeah, that also violates the isotopy term. You see, the main term loves is the isotopy democratic.
No, first of all, I mean, I thought the game is you're going to add random perturbation, right?
Just so I can... Yeah, right, add a random perturbation, but...
So I just, you know, have a source for these strings. It sucks them in or something.
But this perturbation will have to compete with the main term. The ground state, this epsilon, there's an epsilon in front of this V. The ground state is mostly governed by the H0. So let me just put up this last slide, because I'm so impressed with the endurance of this audience. I feel like it's worth getting to the joke that's on the last paragraph. So there's some math here, which at this point is not even worth going into. I think we've talked about it. There is some math project left to do here, besides turning it over to the, charlatans. There's some math project involving Markov chains and actually looking at this Hamiltonian and trying to figure out in the thermodynamic limit if there's an energy gap. That would be very interesting. Both the perturbed and the unperturbed Hamiltonian could be studied in the high refinement limit. And if one found plausible arguments that there were gaps there, maybe even proofs, that would perhaps support these ansatz that I had on the previous slide. If the spectral gap proves too difficult to analyze, then my proposal is just not to worry about it. Build the quantum computer.
The quantum analog of Markov changes the way of constructing a particular perturbation that actually does what you're saying.
Oh, well, yes. Dave, you spoiled the timing of my joke. but science is more important, so we'll go back up here. So H0... H0 is less likely to have a gap than the perturbed Hamiltonian. The reason is because when you study these things for a gap, you're basically interested in the intercommunicability of classical states. How quickly can you get from one to the other by the relations? You know, it's sort of how fat the graph is that is the Markov chain. I mean, this is a symmetric matrix, and it's by adding some weight on vertices, you can convert it into a Markov chain problem. And the projector relations are kind of like freeways that get you quickly from one thing to another, so it really shrinks the graph and makes it rounder. So it's rather problematic whether the original Hamiltonian is gapped, but I think the perturbation, under perturbation, which will find this P projector relation, it may very well be gapped, and I think that's a beautiful mathematical problem to try to study that.
Do you actually have
a candidate?
Yeah.
Well,
picks out this.
So that's what this reference is. There's a paper early this year in which I write down an explicit Hamiltonian whose ground state is exactly this quotient C star algebra. But I regard this as a rather poor piece of work, because all I did was build the projector relation in by brute force.
But is it the thing H naught plus a perturbation?
No. It's H naught plus an additional term, and yes, that term could be made small. Again, remember you asked me about the coefficients before. Here again, for topological reasons, there's freedom in choosing those coefficients, so it could be regarded as H naught plus a perturbation.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
And that perturbation is still, is also local.
Yes. It's local, but local in a slightly unpleasant extremity. It requires something like 30 cells or something. So in other words, it's
perturbation.
Yeah, in other words, the definition of local is there's a finite number of C2s in the projectron there, and this requires 30 of those C2s. Because essentially you take the combinatorics of that P4 relation, and you just pound with a hammer and make a perturbation based on those combinatorics. That's why I said it's a rather poor piece of work.
Okay. It's
an existence theorem. Yeah, that's all.
So, do you know anything about gas synthetics?
No, I mean, this is something that you have to be, you know, an analyst. I mean, like a probabilist. I mean, it's a wonderful problem, but it's like real mathematics rather than.
What's the journal at OCM?
What's what?
The journal.
Oh, Focum, Frontiers of Computational Mathematics. I'm an editor, that's why they publish it.
You don't put these things on FPH?
No, they're posted on the QuantPH.
QuantPH.
QuantPH, yeah.
What's the title of the paper?
I can't remember, but it's in volume one.
Your latest? On the
it might be the last one, yeah. But anyway, are you allowed to tell jokes twice? So for those of you who missed it the first time around, this is only, you know, mathematics isn't the only thing in the world. I mean, what we really want to do is build this quantum computer. In fact, Feynman's, who's the person who started the whole business in 84, wanted to build a quantum computer because he couldn't figure out whether certain quantum mechanical Hamiltonians had gaps in the thermodynamic limit. So it's silly to not build the quantum computer because we can't prove that this model has a gap in the thermodynamic limit. If we get a plausible model for H0, go ahead and build the quantum computer and then calculate as Feynman would have. Yeah, that's right. You don't even have to calculate. It's even faster. Well, thank you for your patience.